Spout Blog and the Webby-nominated Film Couch podcast are covering what's truly interesting in the film world every day. Find out why the New York Times says Spout Blog's got it all at blog.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Matty Robbins.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week, summer, what power you have to make us suffer and like it. Truer words may never have been written. Find out what movies Maddie and I can't wait to suffer through this season as we count down our top five most anticipated summer movies.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by the Scotland Yard Gospel Choir, and a review of The Visitor, the latest film from the writer-director of The Station Agent, Tom McCarthy.
But first, we play Where's Waldo with Morgan Spurlock in Where in the World is Osama Bin Laden? Do it, Rockapella.
If I've learned anything from big-budget action movies, it's that complicated global problems are best solved by one lonely guy.
Where are you going to be going?
We're going to go look for Osama Bin Laden.
Okay.
If I'm going to find Osama, then I'm going to be traveling to some pretty scary places.
This course is reality-based protection.
Turn away from the grenade.
Boom!
How do I say, don't take me, take the cameraman?
Maddie, about a month ago during our review of Kimberly Pierce's Iraq war drama Stop Loss, we discussed how the recent spate of narrative films that could all be bunched together loosely under the nebulous heading War on Terror have mostly been disappointments. Movies like Stop Loss, Redacted, Rendition, and arguably a bit more successfully In the Valley of Ella. While the documentaries have all been illuminating and probably even more dramatic, Taxi to the Dark Side, No End in Sight, Iraq in Fragments. Now we get Morgan Spurlock's take on American foreign policy as he gallivants across the Middle East trying to find out why they hate us and who they are, under the guise of searching for Osama bin Laden in the hope of catching him and making the world a safer place for the child growing inside his wife's belly. Does Spurlock continue the documentary winning streak or finally break the trend?
It's broken.
Yeah.
Completely, completely broken. You know, Adam, you and I are baseball fans. You know when you're at a ball game, August or July.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hot day. After 3 hours of baseball, you've been cooked by the sun. You're just sort of caked in film and dust, and the back of your knee just turns into a pool of sweat. You know, it's sort of fermenting into a toxic combination of nacho cheese and stale beer. Basically, the first 20 minutes of Where in the World is Osama bin Laden, Morgan Spurlock takes my head and rams it into the back of his sweaty knee.
Ouch.
That's how offensive this film is. And I get really upset in this country, living in this age of information where basically a wealth of information is only a mouse click away, including a podcast that will talk to you about movies. And somehow the arguments in this country are being dumbed down. And of course, take this how you will. This is brought to you by the guy that brings you Maddie's Movie Minute. But everything in this country now seems to be black and white. There's no examination of the gray, of the nuance. And it's basically because it's all our attention span can hold. The first 30 minutes of this film are filled with nonsensical bric-a-brac.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Reality Bites? The Ben Stiller character takes Ethan Hawke's footage of his friends for a reality TV show, and he gusses it up with fast edits and graphics. That's what the first part of this movie felt like to me. About the time he trots out Osama bin Laden dancing to the tune of You Can't Touch This, I
mm-hmm.
almost left.
Yeah.
I was absolutely in despair watching this thing.
It's funny you brought that scene up because I'd actually blocked it out of my memory. It's so bad.
Yeah.
I really had hoped to forget that one. But I'm right there with you on this film. And it's funny because I try not to take too seriously what the marketing people say about their films, what you read maybe in press notes or in the plot synopses you might find online. But I think here it really is interesting to check out. This is what the Weinstein Company had to say about what you get from this film. He interviews many people who embrace him on the streets and welcome him into their homes, often experiencing their cultures in ways that sharply contrast with the conventional media images of the region. Spurlock finds they're not that different from American families, sharing the same hopes and fears for their children that he has for his own. Where in the World is Osama bin Laden goes beyond shedding light on the one man that has shaped the world's perception of a region and its people. Spurlock risks life and limb to uncover the truth about bin Laden, and in doing so explores the lines that divide, those that unite, and the countless shades of gray between. Now, needless to say, you
yeah.
disagree
Where
with that.
Where was the gray?
I mean, unfortunately, that's not the film we got. If we had, it would be a really good film. Where I do give Spurlock some credit is that he does take us into these homes as that blurb says, of some of these people, and he shows us how they live, what they believe, that they don't all want to commit jihad against America. And the fact is, no matter how enlightened and educated you are or think you are, Maddie, I would say that that's not a bad thing to remind us Americans that that is the way it really is, because it really is easy to lump people into one big category. The problem, though, is that we actually get very little beyond that from country to country. He goes to Morocco and Israel and Afghanistan and Pakistan, and it's all the same. It's the same conversations, the same questions, many of the same answers. It all starts to become very redundant, all the same grounds being covered.
Well, it's because the conceit is absolutely ridiculous. I don't believe for a second. In fact, I know that Morgan Spurlock knows what being a Muslim is. I've watched a television show devoted to that, one that he produced. So I don't believe for a second that he's actually worried about bringing his child into this world, using that as an excuse to go around the world and find out about all this culture. He already knows this stuff, and it's boring to watch.
Yeah, it really is. And again, that last line of that synopsis, he risks life and limb to uncover the truth about bin Laden, and he explores those shades of gray. The problem is, you're absolutely right. He simplifies everything, or he insists really on telling us a lot instead of showing us, which is something I know you bring up as a criticism of many films. I actually want to play a quick clip here that I think shows that a little bit.
So this classroom was blown up about 8.5 hours ago. Luckily, there were no kids in it. Rocket came from the Gaza Strip. There'd be kids in here, half of them be dead. You see this and you just get a sense of just how wrong things are. I can't imagine raising my kid up in a place like this. I couldn't imagine living in a place where my kid went to school and this is something that could happen every day.
You don't need to tell us that. No. You actually could have just shown that. It could have been much more poignant, or go and actually talk to someone who sends their kids to that school and get their perspective on what it's like living
there. Don't Sesame Street it
up. How hard it is.
Yeah.
It really is kind of naive. He ends up coming off really naive in those scenes, and I know some of it he's being faux naive and he's trying to elicit answers, but that really bothered me, that sort of dynamic of constantly telling us things that really we can see for ourselves. And also that line about going after exploring who Osama bin Laden is, that sounds really good, but the fact is, I don't know what Spurlock's going to teach us about Osama bin Laden anyway, but we don't get anything at all. It really is just a stunt, so he has a hook for his film, and I agree that it's a catchy hook, but it's so contrived, I didn't buy a second of it.
Exactly. I think about halfway through I got into this film a little bit more, when his thesis finally begins to develop. I like the message of winning hearts and minds, especially of Afghanis. I mean, we're spending billions of dollars on the war on terror, but we can win these people over if we just build them some damn schools, give them some clean water. Then we won't lose these young Muslim men to these madrasas, to these training camps and so forth, because they're so disenfranchised. They want to rebel. Then turn that same lens here in Chicago. We just got through a weekend, basically, where gangland violence was at an all-time high. And so in my mind, I actually liked sort of making that connection, saying, yeah, maybe we should look at our own domestic programs here in the United States, because, again, we have our own young American men turning to the only ways of life that they know how. Yeah, exactly. So that, when he finally develops an intelligent thesis that I can latch onto and start speaking to me like an adult, that's when this film scores. All the other puff stuff just doesn't work.
Yeah, it really is surprising here how little I found him, Morgan Spurlock, to be entertaining. And I've read interviews with him. Scott Tobias has a good one this week in the AV Club. And I've seen him in interviews on TV. I think he's a really likable and smart guy. But there was one scene, I think, in this movie that actually got a laugh from me. I know you did, too. I don't remember the scene. But really, our entire audience was pretty quiet throughout this movie. And he is going for laughs in a lot of scenes. And I really do think it does stem from what you said, how contrived everything is here. I mean, this whole conceit of him risking his life while his partner is going through childbirth classes to make the world a better place, you never buy it for a second. All
I could
think about is not only how lucky he is to have a wife that will let him go on this trip, but a wife who will indulge him so much in his work that she'll go along with such a flimsy premise. I mean, I hope that in the end she was satisfied with the product, as obviously we weren't, because she went through a lot and it never really felt like it made sense why he was leaving her back at home so he can go off and try to find Osama bin Laden, which isn't really what he was doing anyway. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, it's a framework for a movie that is basically exploiting his own family life.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a disaster.
It really is in a lot of ways.
I think the only other thing I liked about this film is when he was in Saudi Arabia, just because that country is so foreign to me and I am so fascinated by it. And it also reinforced to me, and you know, here I go, whenever I say anything pro-American on this show, we get deluged with about 20 or 30 emails saying, ah, you're such a homer, Maddie. Well, the fact of the matter is, I love our separation of church and state in this country, and watching a movie like this only reinforces it even more and shows us my God, we don't know anything about these people. We really don't know their values. We don't know their societies. It's really sort of a very foreign, very sort of intimidating place to be. That's when it scored, when it really felt like a stranger in a strange land.
No, those scenes really do work. And the scenes that don't work, like we've discussed, the ones in the beginning, for example, where he goes and gets combat training. It's sort of fun to watch him go through all these things about how to learn how to be a superhero, kind of, how to be
dumb,
an action hero.
Dumb.
But the fact is, why? Just to satisfy this action movie motif that he tries to run through the movie, it doesn't work. It feels so forced. And, you know, even I have to say, too, I don't want to give anything away, but the ending of the film, he tries to turn it into this very dramatic, real moment, and it's very phony. When he finally gets a moment where he has to make a tough decision to choose between his family or this trip is essentially how he tries to sell it. It rings so false. And I know that kind of phoniness maybe isn't a huge crime in a movie that is so artfully constructed to begin with, but it really did just sort of put the nail in the coffin for me with this film. So unfortunately, we could not get behind Where in the World is Osama Bin Laden. It is out now in limited release. And if you get a chance to see it and you agree or disagree with our take, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. Up next, Massacre Theater, and Adam and I go soul searching with Richard Jenkins in The Visitor. Stay with us.
I was far away from my Saccio and frescoes in the Brancacci Chapel. I was thinking about you, boy, ungodly thoughts I know, but I'm not ashamed. I was dreaming I was filming a picture with you on an island there. Somewhere off the mainland, we were alone, we were getting some practice in. I'm Sandro Botticelli, I'm torn between the old and new, between the way I've always thought I should be and the feelings that I have for you for more. Well, who'd have thought I could feel this way for a boy? I never thought I could feel this way for a boy.
Well, now you're squinting like you need glasses.
Well, what do you...
Look at me.
What?
What I'm thinking is, you're mine, known you. But what I'm not doing is feeling one way or another about it. You see, you're not a person to me. You're an entry in my book. That's all. You're just the guy who owes me money.
All right. How about this?
Ooh. Wow. Not bad. Mm. Not bad. No wonder you're Martin Weir.
Oh, yeah.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. Time now for Massacre Theater, the part of the show wherein Adam and I massacre a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a beloved free DVD of your choice. Now, last week, we massacred the scene you just heard with John Travolta and Danny DeVito from Get Shorty, a very, very loose tie-in with our Sarasota Film Festival discussion. Get Shorty, of course, opens in Miami, Florida.
Yes, we were going for a Florida connection there. It was lost on some people, and we certainly understand.
Right. Well, I think originally I had suggested
Some Like It Hot,
because, of course, those two guys go from Chicago down to Florida, but we had done it before.
We had done it before, so it didn't work. Otherwise, it would have been a great choice. You did help give the scene away with the Mr. Cotter line. The best comment, though, I think, to last week's Massacre Theater came from Greg Carnes in London, Ontario. Adam, oh my God, they should have cast you in Battlefield Earth.
All right, Adam, reaching the Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Eddie D'Angelini from Torrance, California.
Eddie from Torrance?
Not to be confused with Eddie Adams from Torrance. Congratulations, Eddie. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
I'll say action. Eddie, that'll be your cue, right? You come through the door, you walk right over here to the desk, to Amber, and shoot.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and the scene does tie in to our theme for this week, our top five summer movies. Maddie, you started off. I'm going to give you the action.
Okay.
And action.
I'm keeping him.
What is it?
He won't hurt you, Blank. He won't hurt you, Blank. We're not going to hurt you.
Is he a boy or a girl?
He's a boy.
Was he wearing any clothes?
No, but look, you can't tell. Not even Mom.
Why not?
Because grown-ups can't see him. Only little kids can see him.
Give me a break.
Well, do you know what's going to happen if you do tell?
End scene. All right, if you know what film, what great summer movie we just massacred, email your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback@filmspotting.net by Wednesday, April 30th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit us at www.filmspotting.net.
So you know where you're staying tonight?
You like music, huh? Me too. Thanks again for letting us stay.
Hi.
Sounded good, Walter.
I'm sorry.
Come on, I'll show you. Walter and I are going up to the park to play, and we'll come back then. Promise, Habibti.
What does Habibti mean?
It means beloved one.
Does she know that?
In The Visitor, Richard Jenkins plays a Connecticut college professor whose wife has recently died. While in New York to present a paper, he finds a couple squatting in his apartment. Sympathetic to their plight, he lets them stay and forms a bond with them that is put to the test when one of them, Tariq, possibly an illegal immigrant, is nabbed by the NYPD and sent to a federal detention center. On the surface, the film is very much in line with director Tom McCarthy's Station Agent, another film featuring a protagonist coping with loss through the forging of friendships with some rather unique individuals. But since this is sort of a political week here on Film Spotting, we're coupling this review, of course, with Where in the World is Osama Bin Laden, I'm wondering if there's a political statement here, maybe a quiet one, and is it effective?
Well, I definitely think there is one here, and it's a lot like the one that I think Spurlock tries to make, and at least the one point maybe he makes well. I think any movie that deals with issues of immigration and specifically shows an immigration policy that is, if not totally broken, at least heavily flawed, has to be seen as political. I think you're also making a political statement just by giving audiences the other here in the form of Tariq, this Syrian man in this country illegally who just wants to play his music and lead a normal life with his girlfriend from Senegal, same as the rest of us, minus the Senegalese girlfriend, of course. It's very similar to what I said about Spurlock, where he simply tries to show us how these people who could easily be cast together as our enemies are really no different than you and me. So even that, I think, is a political statement. But other than a few heavy-handed camera shots, the strength of this film is the way Tom McCarthy clearly just wants us to get to know these characters without any real blatant political discourse. I think it is a lot like The Station Agent. You're absolutely right. His real agenda, I think, is giving us these satisfying slices of life and more or less letting us draw our own conclusions about the politics, which is why I did enjoy this movie.
No, you're absolutely right. It is a matter of showing, not telling. He says, all right, I am going to paint a character portrait right here. These are these characters. You editorialize. You take from it what you will. Yes, there are some ill-advised shots of the Statue of Liberty here and there that sort of hit you over the head a little bit. But this is, it's a very, very nice film. I think that's ultimately my gut reaction. How very nice,
right.
How very charming. But what makes it for me is Dick Jenkins' performance. He is tremendous, absolutely tremendous. It's so meticulous, so understated. I think it's the performance of the year.
Really?
Absolutely brilliant. And he's always been one of my favorite actors. I mean, most people would recognize him as sort of the character actor. The Farrelly brothers used him a lot, of course, the Rhode Island connection there.
6 Feet Under, he was the father. That's what I think.
Yeah, exactly. And I think he's just absolutely wonderful here. And it's not a Philip Seymour Hoffman kind of role. There's no tricks.
It's
there's
not
no
showy.
Ticks. It's just like, I'm this real person. I'm just going to go with it. It's beautiful to watch.
Yeah, as anyone who has commented on this movie at all points out, he's kind of the classic that guy.
Yeah.
And it really is great here to see him get a starring vehicle like this. And he really does so much with so little real restraint. And it's funny, you brought up the fact that you think it's your favorite performance of the year so far, the best performance. I equate it with my favorite performance of last year, which is out now on DVD, and that is Frank Langella.
Ah, Starting Out in the
Evening. Starting Out in the Evening, exactly. If you want to see a masterclass on subtle acting, watch this movie and then go rent Starting Out in the Evening with Langella. You'll get to see very similar characters, two widowed intellectuals who have pretty much thrown in the towel on life and are brought back into life by others that they encounter. Really great acting here. I completely agree. And I'm with you, too, that nice is about the best description you can come up with for this film. I sort of see it as the anti-Almodovar in a lot of ways. After, you know, we've had this Almodovar marathon, there aren't really any surprises here at all. not in terms of where the story goes. You see it coming the entire time. There's no surprises to the characters even. I mean, even Richard Jenkins, Walter, as he decides to sort of engage life again, we see that coming. He never really resists life in any way. When he's given the opportunity, he embraces it. You see where it's going from the beginning, and yet you still want to go for the ride.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. It's a very, very soft film. It's sort of formulaic. We can see about 8 miles ahead of us. But the fact of the matter is that there's no real struggle, even though the stakes are really, really high. They're much higher than the station agent. And yet, I never felt the characters here working against anything to any sort of extreme measure.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody in this film sort of finds their comfort cloud and just sort of rides it throughout the rest of the picture. So at the end of the day, I was like, well, okay,
right.
But what happened?
Right.
I kept waiting for just, you know, one more turn of the screw, something to actually come in and say, all right, now you're going to be put to the test. I need to see your mettle. I need to see how you react in this situation.
Right. I agree. You don't get a lot of that. And I do think, though, I will give him credit again for making some of those political statements in fairly subtle ways. There is a great moment, I think, where this goofy professor who's at the same conference as Richard Jenkins, Walter has decided to stop and watch this drum circle. And I can't remember if Tarek is actually in that drum circle or not, but he's watching this drum circle. And another professor comes up and he makes this goofy joke. Maybe we should invite him up to the conference to play for us. And the irony there, of course, what McCarthy is saying is, yeah, they actually should. You have a conference on globalization. How enlightening could that conference be? Sitting around listening to a bunch of middle-aged white academics discussing the economies, right, of developing countries when you actually have immigrants from these countries right outside. That's what he wants you to see. Where I do recoil a little bit, though, is all of the other characters, meaning the characters outside of our main characters, they all sort of fall into that same role of, like, the goofy white guy who makes the inappropriate joke, the snobby upper-class woman who thinks that Cape Town is near Senegal. He sort of wants us to laugh at these people, maybe a little bit too much, but it's such a small part of the film.
So what you're saying is it sort of suffers from Dances with Wolves disease,
maybe,
where there's only one white guy that actually can understand the plight of these people?
Yeah, exactly. But I also have to ask you, Maddie, I really want your take on this, because I have to confess I did feel this way at the end of the film a little bit. And I don't consider myself someone who is really politically correct. I don't get worked up or offended by things that usually would fall into that category. And in this film, Jenkins is so restrained, McCarthy so restrained, as we've talked about, with the kind of political message that it's hard to get too worked up by it. But at the end of the film, and I'm not going to give away the final shot or anything, I did react a little bit like we both did to the Darjeeling Limited, where I think it's a little bit difficult to watch a movie about how the white guy, the bourgeois white guy, is redeemed essentially through the suffering of non-whites, of the foreign characters here. I mean, I'm so glad that Richard Jenkins gets to go on with his life and maybe find a little bit more of happiness, but at what cost? It sort of wants us just to forget in the end what the cost is, what happens to these foreigners here. I had a hard time with that.
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I think it's interesting that you sort of linger on that. I wouldn't go that far. I don't think we're supposed to forget. I really don't. In fact, I think there's another chapter to be written in each of these characters' lives, and I'm hoping in chapter two there's some plot.
Yeah, because there isn't much here. You're absolutely right. Lastly, I do just want to make the comment that we mentioned maybe some of the heavy-handed shots. It's not even just the Statue of Liberty. It's the Statue of Liberty signs on the wall or these other signs at this detention center where they're welcoming you here and talking about freedom. And then, of course, we see the context of the scene where we just saw things unfold. It shows that those sentiments are actually just nonsense. It's all lip service. I don't know that I really needed to see a close-up of those signs, though, or for the camera to linger there to get the message. I will give some credit to McCarthy, though, is I did like how he used the zoom out a couple of times really well. And I bring this up only because you don't really see it much in films. You don't see a director choose to start in close on people and zoom out to a long shot, at least not anymore. Zooms just aren't really that fashionable these days. But what it does is it really does show these characters in their environment. I mean, when Walter and Tarek are walking through Central Park and they've just had this great experience, it's sort of like them letting the world come in, and we literally get the zoom that shows that happening, linking the characters to that great space, the New York City that they're embracing. I really like a couple of those great camera shots.
No, I think you're right. I think sort of the Michael Curtiz school of directing, if you will, again, establishing who these people are. And, of course, the big world where we all live and we all walk hand in hand, even if we don't realize it.
You had to get in a Curtiz reference there. Nicely done. All right. Well, The Visitor is in theaters now in limited release as well. If you agree or disagree with our takes, email feedback@filmspotting.net.
All right. Time for a quick break. Chuck, it's Marvin. your cousin, Marvin Berry. Your top five concert scenes feedback is next. Stay with us.
Here's one of me.
Guys, listen, this is a blues riff from B. Watch me for the changes and try and keep up, okay?
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Matty Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and there it is, the scene from Back to the Future. Marty McFly playing Johnny B. Goode. We're going to get into some great responses to our top five concert scenes here in a minute. One, I'll say right now, I just completely forgot and I feel terrible about. But first, we do want to share our poll questions for this week. Let's go ahead and start with the results for last week's question. We were tying up our Pedro Almodovar marathon. We had the Matadors. We gave out our Almodovar awards. We wanted to know what you thought the best Pedro Almodovar movie is. So here were the choices: All About My Mother, Bad Education, The Flower of My Secret, Live Flesh, Talk to Her, Volver, one of his earlier films, or Wish I Had an Opinion. Maddie, how did it come out this time?
I don't even know why I show up here anymore. I don't know why I do this show.
It's getting hard to
go
on.
Every week, I give my blood. I give everything because, number one, Wish I Had an Opinion at 38%, just like the Bergman Marathon. Mm-hmm. Talk to Her coming in at 26%, Volver, 10%, All About My Mother, 10%, Bad Education, 8%, one of his earlier films, 7%, Live Flesh, 3%, and absolutely no one has either seen or thinks The Flower of My Secret is the best Almodovar film. This is why I drink, Adam.
I know.
What
it
is my
tough.
Life worth?
Well, it is nice at least to see that Talk to Her, which was our pick for our favorite Almodovar film from the marathon, nice to see that that one was second place there. But yeah, a lot of people have to find the time to check out Almodovar. We obviously recommend that you do. This week's poll question relates to our summer movies. Again, in the next segment here, we're going to count down our top five summer movies, the ones we're most looking forward to. But there's so much Drek coming out this season, Maddie, as there is really every summer. This is what I discovered anyway in my research here for the top five, that I thought it would be more fun. Let's ask our listeners what they think their least anticipated summer movie is. The choices are...
Is it The Love Guru, starring Michael Myers, I believe? Mm-hmm. Mamma Mia, I think, based on the ABBA musical, I'm guessing.
It's a musical. Meryl Streep's in it. That's all I know.
Sex and the City, mm-hmm. the movie... Wanted. I don't know anything about that film.
Yes, you do. You watched the trailer the other night with me. It's the Angelina Jolie, James McAvoy sort of superhero film where he can bend bullets as he shoots them out of the gun or something.
I hate that film. Mm-hmm. What Happens in Vegas with Cameron Diaz and the great Ashton Kutcher?
So, Maddie, of those five, which one are you least anticipating?
I think I got to go with probably What Happens in Vegas, although least anticipated, I'm not going to see that film.
No, I'm not going to see maybe any of these films. Well, at least see, I will probably see Sex and the City. I think we may even have to review it. I know you are dreading that, but I agree. The one that looks the worst to me, I would rather hit myself in the head with a blunt object than watch What Happens in Vegas. So that's my vote. Let us know what your vote is by visiting filmspotting.net. A couple of quick notes we wanted to mention. Last week when we talked about the Sarasota Film Festival, I briefly discussed a movie I really enjoyed there at the fest called At the Death House Door by the makers of Hoop Dreams, Peter Gilbert and Steve James. That documentary is actually going to be premiering on IFC May 29th, making its world television premiere. So if that movie sounded intriguing to you, check it out on IFC May 29th. Also wanted to mention Ebertfest is this weekend. Roger Ebert's Overlook Film Festival. I am planning on attending Ebertfest this year. So maybe I'll run into you there. Send us an email if you're going to be around Ebertfest. Feedback at filmspotting.net. We also wanted to mention that we are very aware that My Blueberry Nights, the Wong Kar-wai film that we both do really want to see, is playing now in Chicago. We're also very aware that Ho Xiaoshen's film, the Taiwanese filmmaker that's getting a lot of great critical responses, Flight of the Red Balloon, is also playing now in Chicago. We do plan on checking out both of those films, and if not reviewing them in full, we will certainly give a minute or two to pass along our reaction to those films. Now, Maddie, let's go ahead and get into the mailbag. We wanted to start with a few thoughts on our review of Shine a Light, the Rolling Stones rockumentary from Martin Scorsese.
Caught the Scorsese-Stones collaboration Shine a Light over the weekend. Well, I was looking forward to seeing it, and I can't say that I expected more than a run-of-the-mill performance film. What I got instead was a revelatory cinematic and musical experience, and couldn't sit still throughout. Technically, beyond brilliant. From an 18-member camera crew that reads like a who's who of cinematographers, including their Will Be Blood Oscar winner Robert Elswit, to perfect editing, to one of the best sound mixes I've ever heard by longtime music industry veteran Bob Clearmountain. I encourage anyone remotely interested in the Rolling Stones to see Shine a Light, which to me joins the ranks of Woodstock, Monterey Pop, and Scorsese's The Last Waltz in the category of indispensable concert films. And that's Jeffrey Rosato from Huntsville, Alabama.
And I really hope Jeffrey Rosato continues to listen to our show after suffering through your impression of him.
Well, I'm just trying to give, you know, I'm just trying to play it up a little bit. You know, it's hard. People have to listen to these. We read them, we read them. You know, I'm just trying to play it up a little bit, give them a little variety.
Well, I'm not going to do a Brooklyn accent here as we go to Peter, responding maybe to Jeffrey a little bit, not completely agreeing more with our take on Shine a Light. He says, thanks for mentioning that the Rolling Stones are overshadowed by some of their guests in the latest concert documentary. As you probably know, they have a fine history of being outperformed, most notably in Gimme Shelter, where the Hell's Angels outdo them, and then, of course, in Rock and Roll Circus, where in a stoned and utterly lifeless Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, and crew are completely blown away by John Lennon, Jethro Tull, the Taj Mahal, even Yoko Ono. In that film, the Who make the Rolling Stones look like some high school garage band with their one song, A Quick One While He's Away, allegedly the reason the film wasn't released for 28 years. For my money, though, the Stones have always been best portrayed in Sympathy for the Devil, where at least they put together a great song, even if they're still superseded by Guitar politically / cinematically running his mouth off. Now, I agree completely there, having seen Sympathy for the Devil. That's a great summation of what goes on there. And you've seen Rock and Roll Circus, which I have not. Do you agree with Peter?
I absolutely love Rock and Roll Circus, but he's absolutely right. I forgot how stoned the Stones look in that film, and they are completely outplayed by the likes of John Lennon and The Who.
Okay.
Well, we've got some feedback on our top five concert scenes. Matt Singer, our friend Matt Singer, writes in from New York City. He says, love the concert scenes list with Revenge of the Nerds, Spinal Tap, and Blues Brothers. You had some inspired choices, but I was absolutely flabbergasted to see that you two children of the 80s didn't even honorably mention the single definitive concert scene of the decade, Marty McFly taking the stage with the Starlighters, replacing Marvin, who's injured his hand, on electric guitar, and inadvertently giving birth to rock and roll by giving the Enchantment Under the Sea dance a taste of Johnny B. Goode. Come on, guys, Back to the Future, for crying out loud. My only gripe as an adult, there's no way that gravelly, soulful voice singing Johnny B. Goode is coming out of shrimpy Michael J. Fox's mouth. But when I was 7, did I care about that? Absolutely not. I can't believe you left it off. What gives? Is it in the penalty box or something? That's Matt B. Goode Singer from New York City.
Yeah, Matt, our friend there. And he's absolutely right. As soon as that email came in and the flood of other emails that followed who were absolutely shocked that we left off that scene from Back to the Future, I immediately felt the shame, Maddie, because I have to admit, I love that scene. I once, as a kid, in 5th grade, when this movie came out, I did a talent contest that was like a putting on the hits kind of thing. It was a lip-syncing thing, and I did this scene playing the guitar. I even slid down on my knees like Marty McFly does during the guitar solo. I loved it that much. It easily would have been in my top 5 had I simply remembered it.
Yeah, I boycotted the scene. There's one thing I don't like about it, and it's the fact that, my God, can't black people invent anything? Now we're going to take rock and roll away from them? Chuck Berry didn't invent rock and roll. It's some white guy from the suburbs?
All right.
Thank you. I'll pass.
Well, he was just passing on what he learned from those great black musicians, Maddie, but I guess I'll take your point. Chad Surhall in Indianapolis was one of the others who wrote in. He was really happy to see that we had the Buddy Holly story, but couldn't believe that we didn't mention the greatest scene from the greatest movie ever, Back to the Effin' Future, as he wrote it. George Prentice in San Antonio, Texas writes in, just finished listening to the show, and I can't believe that Adam didn't have the concert scene from A Hard Day's Night as his number one. And this from a self-described Beatles guy. As usual, Ebert summed up the scene so well in his review of the film, which he called one of the greatest life-affirming movies of all time. The film is so tightly cut, there's hardly a down moment, but even with so many riches, it's easy to pick the best scene, the concert footage as the Beatles sing She Loves You. This is one of the most sustained orgasmic sequences in the movies. It's quite simply the best scene in the best rock and roll movie of all time.
Well, Mr. Kempinar, what say you?
I say I haven't seen A Hard Day's Night for ages, like a good 10 years, and I just don't remember the scene. I really do want to revisit it now, though.
No, it's so funny because when we pick these top fives every week, there are so many great scenes, but if they don't jump out and immediately grab me, then they're probably going to fall through the cracks.
I agree.
All right, well, Philip writes in, greetings from Bamberg, the lovely little city in the heart of Franconia in Germany.
This is Sprockets all of a sudden.
Exactly. I've been an avid listener for quite a while now and really enjoy your show very much. I do, however, feel the need to complain a little bit about your top five concert scenes. Of course, Stonehenge has to be at the top. That's out of the question. But why, oh why, did neither of you mention one of the greatest, if not the greatest, concert film ever, which, of course, is Stop Making Sense by the Talking Heads, an amazing band at the peak of their powers, directed by the great Jonathan Demme. This is a wonderfully weird delight from start to finish. And, of course, it is worth a watch just to drool over the hottest bass player in the history of music, Tina Weymouth. A specific scene? Well, you can take any track. They're all superb. But when Byrne and his guitarist completely freak out during Burning Down the House, what other scene can top that?
Well, I know, Maddie, that you left it off, of course, because you weren't going to include any concert films, but I just have to confess I wanted to read this message because of this. I haven't seen Stop Making Sense.
Oh, it's great.
It's the big reason why I didn't want to do top five concert films, because I knew that I could not cop to having not seen this film, or I'd have to watch it, and I just didn't have time before we formed our list. But I really do want to check it out. Your comments are well taken, Philip. Let's go ahead and close here with this one from Andrew in Sydney, Australia. I love the top five concert scenes you guys did. The inclusion of the final battle in 8 Mile was particularly inspired. I didn't think of it, but it's such an incredible scene. I was so glad to hear it. Anyway, I thought I'd send in a few that I thought of. Number three, there's a kiss at the end of the rainbow performed by Mitch and Mickey in A Mighty Wind.
Ooh, I almost included this
it's
one.
It's really good.
I almost included that.
A lot of people wrote in with this one. I was tossing up between this one and the supergroup performance of A Mighty Wind itself, but this is the one that really gets to me with a fantastic performance by Catherine O'Hara. We agree. Number two, I'm a Man of Constant Sorrow performed by the Soggy Bottom Boys in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? The audience reaction sends shivers up my spine. Maddie, you disagree?
No, it's because you can tell that they're lip syncing. That's really, really sort of off-putting for me.
Okay. And number one here, Stroll On, performed by the Yardbirds in Blow Up. Fantastic, exciting scene. The audience grapples for the piece of broken guitar, only to be left on the side of the road after the performance, is true poetry. That's one for me, again, as you pointed out, Maddie. You know the scene, you love it, but if it doesn't immediately pop to your mind, maybe you don't include it. That's why I didn't include it there, but a really good one from that Antonioni film. And Frederick in Östersund, Sweden, what in the name of Dapper Dan do you guys mean? Making a top five list of movie concert moments and not including the best one in years in which George Clooney makes a perfect rendition of a song without using his own voice. I love your show, guys, but this time you broke my heart. Damn, you're in a tight spot, Frederick writes. So again, that was a big one that came up from a lot of listeners. I do love that scene. It's a great Coen Brothers film, and probably should have considered it, but wouldn't have been in my top five. So
no. Well, we'll close out here with Michelle from Tulsa. She writes in, the fact that you guys can put Eminem's 8 Mile, the Blues Brothers' Rawhide scene, and Revenge of the Nerds on your concert list, that's exactly why I love this show.
A perfect place to end, as there ever would be. Thank you, Michelle, and thanks to everyone for the great feedback on our concert scenes in Shine a Light. We will get into more of your feedback on our top five vacation movies and also our discussion of Forgetting Sarah Marshall on next week's show. And we do also have planned an extra podcast edition next week. We will have Film Spotting After Hours with even more of your great feedback. If you have any thoughts for us, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Time for another quick break. When we return, get your popcorn ready as Short Round and I count down our top five most anticipated movies of the summer. Stay with us.
You feel that every night of your adult life's been a night of denial and desertion. I know that in your mind you shared your bread and wine with widows and with orphans. And now you're wondering why your children don't have a time or day for you anymore. You can't understand. You brought it upon yourself. And really, what did you expect?
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD, brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips.
Well, not much that caught our eye coming out this Tuesday, Maddie, but we definitely want to mention Julian Schnabel's film, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. It includes a featurette, audio commentary with Schnabel, and his interview on Charlie Rose. I know you can't wait to check that out, the big Charlie Rose fan that you are, Maddie. But you saw this film. It was my number three film of the year. I really loved this film and had a strong reaction to it. You not so much. You liked it, I think. But
I did like it. I wasn't as emotionally drawn into it. I really enjoyed Max von Sydow, but for whatever reason, I wasn't as attached to it as you were.
I was really heartbroken by it in a lot of ways. For whatever reason, I really do recommend checking out The Diving Bell and The Butterfly. Also out, The Red Balloon. This is in association with the Criterion Collection from Janus Films. And I bring it up only because, as we mentioned earlier in the show, Flight of the Red Balloon, the Ho Xiao Shen film, coming out now in theaters based on this French film from, I believe, 1956. A short film, I want to say 40 minutes or so, one I do want to check out. And finally, The Golden Compass, a movie, Maddie, that we didn't review here on the show. It includes an audio commentary by the director Chris Weitz and behind-the-scenes footage. So maybe if you have some children that were a fan of that film, one you might want to check out. And you can get all the DVDs we mentioned in this segment at great prices through TLAvideo.com. Just click on the Film Spotting Movie Store link at filmspotting.net. We also want to promote, again, our recast contest going on right now over at Spout.com. We are recasting Ghostbusters. And Maddie, you threw down the challenge last week saying, how could you do it? How could you put somebody else in the role of Bill Murray? I have to say, the responses are flying in. They're really impressive so far. There's one Broken Lizard edition of Ghostbusters. There's a Frat Pack edition with Owen Wilson as Bill Murray. There's an Apatow Clan edition. There's even one with Sam Rockwell in the Venkman role. I got to say, I know it's blasphemy, but Rockwell may be the best thing you could put in there.
No, it's too soon.
It's too soon. Well, make your entry over at recast.spout.com. The first place winner, the one chosen by the fine people over at Spout, the cast they like the best, you're going to win some great American Apparel swag. And a second prize winner is going to win a DVD from us that will be announced here later on the show. But again, we really look forward to checking out what you come up with, your creative ideas. If you had to remake Ghostbusters, in this case, only if you had to, who would you put in some of those iconic roles? Again, visit recast.spout.com.
Okay, right now we want to thank everyone who found their way over to filmspotting.net and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. We are humbled, as always, by each and every donation. Thank you, thank you, thank you to Giza in beautiful Auckland, New Zealand, and to Chad in beautiful Kenmore, Washington.
We have quite a few listeners in Auckland, New Zealand, actually, so hello to all of them. And we also want to say real quick, Maddie, that in case we missed you this week, your donation didn't come in time for us to record the show, we'll get to you next week. Don't worry.
Also, remember that for every $10 you donate, your name is entered into the Film Spotting hat. At the end of the month, Adam, we pick a name. You get to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours. The first one coming up next week, Love Actually. If you'd like to donate, go to filmspotting.net and click on the donation tab at the top of the page. So if you must know,
you are listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. It's top five time here on the show. We're counting down our top five summer movies, the five films coming out this summer we cannot wait to see. Maddie, the past couple weeks during this segment, you've had a lot of rules and restrictions. Did you once again impose restrictions on yourself or come up with any themes? Or is this just the five flat-out movies you most want to see?
No, I mean, summer's coming. All right, just around the corner. I want to get everybody just hot and bothered, just sort of bursting with anticipation, like a good D.H. Lawrence novel.
Can't wait.
So here we go. My number five, Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants 2.
Uh-huh.
Number four, The Mummy, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor. Actually, no, they're not on my list. It really looks kind of bleak out there.
Yeah, it does.
All right. Well, my honorable mention, Hellboy 2, actually one that I'm looking forward to, Step Brothers, the new Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly comedy, and Vicky Cristina Barcelona, the Woody Allen film. All right. Well, my number five, Crossing Over. This thing really could be terrible, but it's about illegal immigration, and it stars Harrison Ford and Sean Penn and our favorite, Ray Liotta.
Wow.
And you know, my only goal here as a host of Film Spotting is to one day get Ray Liotta on the show so he can say, you're listening to Film Spotting.
and get him to laugh like he does in Goodfellas and say, Karen.
Karen.
You know we need him to say Karen. I look forward to that. That's now a dream of mine as well. I have to admit, I saw that little blurb in Entertainment Weekly in their summer preview, and I managed, despite the fact that it has Harrison Ford, Ray Liotta, Sean Penn, I completely decided to just overlook it. For some reason, it didn't sound interesting
to me. It could be awful, something in the veins of Lions and Lambs or Rendition only instead of about the war, about immigration.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will see. I did impose some rules this week. For me, the big one, no superhero movies. That includes Iron Man. It includes The Incredible Hulk. It includes The Dark Knight. It even includes Hellboy 2, and yes, I'm putting Indiana Jones in there because, let's face it, he really is a superhero. I just thought that would be boring. Of course, those would be on my most anticipated list. If not in the top five, close. The Dark Knight would be number one. Iron Man probably number two. Just gets boring. So what I've got here, even though you could argue I'm taking some of the fun out of the summer with some of those picks, I'm trying to put the funny back in the summer. And yes, I did work on that all day, Maddie, just to have that prepared for tonight. My number five, though, let's go ahead and hear a clip.
It's done.
Hamlet 2? Doesn't everybody die at the end of the first one?
I have a device.
The time machine opens, revealing Hamlet and...
Jesus!
Good luck.
Thanks, Jesus.
You got my cell number?
Yeah.
Okay.
The musical accompaniment to our play will be provided by the Gay Men's Chorus of Tucson.
Just a steel town girl on a Saturday. And that's Hamlet 2. That was the film that really was the big hit at Sundance. Unfortunately, we didn't get to see it while we were out in Park City. But you've got Steve Coogan, who we love, as a failed actor, turns to teaching high school drama, decides to put on a sequel to Hamlet as a musical, with the signature song being Rock Me, Sexy Jesus. And I just think that if you're a fan of Waiting for Guffman, this film certainly is going to fall right into line with that movie, kind of the anti-Mr. Holland's opus. Yeah. And let's face it, those movies deserve to be taken down a little bit. It could be totally a miss, but I think it could be a big hit as well. I'm looking forward to it. So it's one of my three comedies here on my top five, Hamlet 2.
All right, well, it's your number five. It's good enough for my number four, Hamlet 2. You and I can go together, share some popcorn. I really think you're right. Mr. Holland's Opus, a movie I actually kind of like.
Me too.
Goodbye, Mr. Chips, another film I really like. But they're ripe for satire.
Okay, well, my number four, I wonder if this one will be on your list. Definitely not a conventional summer movie here, but I am going with Red Belt. This is the new David Mamet film, and maybe I'm one of the few people out there. I know there are others in Film Spotting Land who get excited about the next David Mamet film. It stars Chiwetel Ejiofor, and I just want to read you briefly the plot synopsis here. Set in the West Side Los Angeles fight world, a world inhabited by bouncers, cage fighters, cops, and special forces types.
And Ricky J.
Red Belt is the story of Mike Terry, a jiu-jitsu master who has avoided the prize fighting circuit, choosing to instead pursue an honorable life by operating a self-defense studio with the samurai's code. Somehow he gets involved with a movie star played by Tim Allen. Of course, it's a Mamet film, so his wife, Rebecca Pigeon's in it. Also, Ricky J., Joe Mantegna, Mamet's favorite actor, a ton of testosterone. The trailer is just an absolute trip. It's really bizarre looking, but it's Mamet. I do love Chiwetel Ejiofor. I want to see him as a jiu-jitsu master. I can't wait for Red Belt.
I'm going to win that belt. I'm going to win the belt.
You're believing yourself.
I'm going to win the belt.
That takes talent.
I cannot wait. All right. Well, my number three is Pineapple Express. One of my favorite characters of all time is Gary from True Romance. Brad Pitt. Come on. You, Mr. Down on Mr.
Pitt. I like him there.
All right. Thank you. Basically, this movie is about two Gary-like characters that witness a murder, and I think they get chased across the country. Seth Rogen, I think, plays the straight guy, and James,
Franco,
the acting machine,
he's the pothead.
Plays the pothead. I'm really looking forward to this.
Well, it was your number three. It's good enough for my number three again. This is my comedy list here. Let's go ahead and hear a scene from Pineapple Express.
It's been 2 months you've been coming to me, right?
So with the suit?
I'm a process server.
You're a servant? Like a butler?
No. I serve out like subpoenas. I gotta wear like disguises sometimes.
Disguise? Wish I had an easy job like you have.
You have the easiest job on earth. You smoke all day.
And you didn't mention, Maddie, that the most bizarre thing about this film is that it's this Apatow comedy, which he initially wrote, and then Seth Rogen and his super bad buddy Evan Goldberg rewrote. David Gordon Green, the director of Undertow and Snow Angels and George Washington, is the guy directing this comedy, which is just crazy. I agree with you. I love that Brad Pitt character in True Romance. knowing that they based it off of that. And Apatow's exact line was that he always loved that character, so he wanted to follow that guy out of his apartment and watch him get chased by the bad guys. I think that is a great idea for a movie. And I do like James Franco. Seth Rogen, I want to see what he's going to follow up with after Superbad and Knocked Up. So I'm with you. Pineapple Express looks hilarious.
All right. Well, for my number two, let's go ahead and hear a clip.
You've changed things. Forever. There's no going back. See, to them, you're just a freak. Like me.
That is, of course, from The Dark Knight. And I just have to say, I'm not a huge Batman guy. I like the first one with Michael Keaton. I actually still think it's the best one. Mm-hmm. I wasn't particularly fond of the last one. But I will say, I'll admit, I'm completely bought into the hype around this one because of Heath Ledger's untimely
really?
Death.
That did amplify it for
it
you?
It did, because he looks so sinister as the Joker. So every time I watch a trailer now, my interest keeps getting piqued more and more.
You're a little bit drawn into the macabre there, Matt.
Yeah. Like Batman, I have a dark side.
There you go. Okay, well, my number two, my third and final comedy here for my top five list, it is Tropic Thunder, written, starring, and directed by Ben Stiller, who doesn't have the greatest track record lately, but when you've got a film where you've got a bunch of prima donna actors making a war movie and then sort of get sucked into an actual war with the cast like Stiller, Jack Black, Robert Downey Jr., Nick Nolte, Steve Coogan, Jay Baruchel, Tom Cruise is in it, and apparently very funny. Matthew McConaughey even makes an appearance. I have to say from the trailer, Robert Downey Jr. dyes his skin black, his character does, to play an African-American sergeant. He looks pretty insane and pretty funny in the movie. So it comes out August 15th. What can I say? I want to see the next Ben Stiller film. It looks great.
God, jeez. You're one step ahead of me on every single one of these.
It's, well, get used to
it. You're number two. It's my number one. For all the reasons you just mentioned, I am dying to see this film.
Don't you die on me, Foley!
I'm sorry, can we cut? Amy, can we cut?
What is going on here?
I'm about to jump out this helicopter like Wesley Snipes.
I'm doing the scene right now.
What
I'm
scene?
In it.
The scene is about emotionality. Where is it?
God! I am dealing with a bunch of prima donnas.
The action guy who left the fridge open. The award winner.
Critically acclaimed Australian actor Kirk Lazarus underwent a controversial procedure in order to play the platoon's African-American sergeant.
I know who I am! I'm a dude playing a dude disguised as another dude!
Okay, well, that brings me to my number one. Decidedly not a summer movie, but perfectly in keeping with the theme of this week's show. I cannot wait to see, and it's coming up here in a couple weeks, the new Errol Morris documentary, Standard Operating Procedure.
Oh, good pick.
Yeah,
good pick.
I know you were really looking forward to that one. It kind of explores Abu Ghraib by looking at the photographs and talking to the people who took the photographs, tries to get at those questions of what is going on outside the frame that made those pictures possible. I think Errol Morris is the perfect guy for it. And looking at the trailer, wow, he's got some amazing visualizations of what was going on and really just finds a way to bring what could be kind of pedestrian subject matter just in terms of its interviews, its talking heads, its photographs, making it really interesting to look at visually. I love Errol Morris.
Yeah, I think we should all chip in and send Morgan Spurlock to make sure he sees this film.
Yeah, and actually, I want to say that in the Scott Tobias interview with the AV Club, Morgan Spurlock mentions how much he loves Errol Morris. Maybe he needs to take a few more pages from his book. So that movie looks fascinating to me. We do plan to have a review of that here on the show in a few weeks. You had some honorable mentions, Maddie. I agree. I've got Step Brothers in there, another Apatow production with John C. Reilly and Will Ferrell. Dick Jenkins from The Visitor in that movie as their father. I also want to see Vicky Cristina Barcelona, the next Woody Allen film. I'm kind of curious about The Happening, the M. Night Shyamalan film. I can't help it. I sort of get sucked into those movies for some reason.
What is it? Is it the Shyamalan or is it the Wahlberg?
It's more the
or
Shyamalan.
Or is it the combination of the two?
Maybe the combination of the two. Maybe something macabre about that pairing as well. I don't know. But I do have to mention real quick as well, three movies to pay attention to coming out. Three movies that have played the festival circuit that I was really excited to see are getting finally a summer release. Son of Rambo, which we talked about here on this show back at the 2007 Sundance, coming out here in May, I believe. My Winnipeg, the Guy Madden film that we like so much from the Toronto Film Festival, going to come out in limited release June 13th. And American Teen, the movie I talked about briefly last week, my favorite film of the five I saw at the Sarasota Film Festival, going to get, it looks like, a wide release, either July 25th or August 1st. Definitely keep an eye out for that one. We're going to review it here on the show, hopefully talk to the director as well.
All right, well, those are our top five most anticipated summer movies. Please send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Opening wide this weekend, Maddie, one of those movies that could have gone on the least anticipated poll question, Maid of Honor with Patrick Dempsey and Michelle Monaghan, though I do like Michelle Monaghan, and Iron Man, the big release this week, obviously, with Robert Downey Jr., Gwyneth Paltrow, Terrence Howard. Isn't Bridges in it as well? I want to say Jeff Bridges is in Iron Man, or am I crazy?
And directed by Favreau.
And directed by Favreau. On next week's show, we will have a review of Iron Man, and we're going to share our top five. Now, this is a great topic, Maddie, that you came up with. It should be fun. Our top five bombs that didn't suck. So these are big movies, big budgets that absolutely tanked at the box office, but that we think are actually worth watching.
Maybe a little Waterworld action?
Speaking of tanking,
I think Kevin Costner might figure highly into my list.
Maybe so. Maybe not on mine, though. We'll see.
We'll also kick off our 70s sci-fi marathon. Really looking forward to that one with a discussion of The Omega Man. Thanks, as always, to our wonderful listener volunteers, Candace, Frank, and Angela. Special thanks to Joe Dassault, Ron Jones, and Tori Malatia at Chicago Public Radio, and to the Scotland Yard Gospel Choir and Bloodshot Records for this week's music. Learn more at bloodshotrecords.com. Also, don't forget to check out all the great Film Spotting swag available at filmspottingswag.com.
Though by next week, it might actually be changed to filmspottingmerch.com. We got a voicemail today from a listener in Nashville, Thomas, telling us that we're using swag improperly there because it denotes free items. We're selling these t-shirts, so maybe it should be filmspottingmerch.com. We'll have to look into that for next week.
Either way, check it out.
Check it out, please.
For Film Spotting, I'm Maddie Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips. Learn more by visiting the Film Spotting movie store at filmspotting.net.
I've been an avid listener for quite a while now and really enjoy your show very much.
What accent is this?
I have no idea. It's Huntsville, Alabama.
Uh-huh.
I do, however, feel the need to complain a little bit about your top five concert scenes.
I think the only thing that can top that, maybe, Maddie, is you doing Philip's voice as if you were Rudyard Kipling. Shit. No, that was kind of funny.
No, it's all right. It's all right. I'll do it again.
But, I mean, that was nothing German about that.
Well, because I didn't know. All right, so I can do German.
How can you do German?
It's 8 seconds. I can use the German.
I don't think you should do the whole thing in a German accent. Maybe just the beginning or something.
Okay. The Love Guru, starring Michael Myers, I believe. Mm-hmm. Mama fucking Mia.
I put that in just for you, Maddie, because I knew how excited you were.
Okay.
Take two. You ready? For the top five?
Top five. Top five of all time. Here we go.
Okay.